Welcome to part one of a very special episode of Story Breakers. My name is Chris Brennan, and today you're getting exclusive access to our Dublin Comic Con live reading of J.J. Abrams' 2003 Superman flyby script. Originally written to be part of a trilogy, if this film was made, it would have changed the landscape of Hollywood blockbuster cinema as we know it. When they first started, Warner Brothers signed up Brett Ratner to direct the film, but after some casting complications and a violent dispute with John, I Wanted Giant Spider Peters, Brett Ratner left the project. In 2003, then, McGee signed up to direct. He was looking to cast in Robert Downey Jr. or Johnny Depp as Lex Luthor, and Scarlett Johansson as Lois Lane. However, when he found out that the studio wanted to film in Australia, he left the project saying that there's no way you can film an American project in Australia, but later on turns out it was actually a fear of flying, they turned it down. That's when J.J. championed to take over, but he was told no. I guess they didn't really believe he could handle blockbuster cinema as a director. And that's when Bryan Singer signed up. Now, Singer threw out J.J.'s script and decided to do a sequel to the original Superman 2. And then J.J.'s script floated to the bottom of the Hollywood Sea. Until today. So today, your players for the show are Lex Luthor in Katazor is Morgan C. Jones, Lois Lane and Martha Kent, played by Donna Nicolaisen. Jor-El and Perry White is played by David O'Neill. Ty-Zor is played by Liam Cooney. Jimmy Olsen and Jonathan Kent is played by Kieran Marcantonio. And all the ancillary characters are played by Wayne Talbot. Your Man of Steel for the show is Donna Humphreys. And bringing it all together is the breathless narrator himself, Niall Bruton. If you enjoy this, all we ask is that you subscribe and share this episode with your friends, peeps, and peers so they can find out what happened to J.J. Abrams' long-lost Superman script. And also stick around at the end of part one where I provide a mini script review of the first half. Enough from me, though. Let's get on with the show.
Superman flyby. A TV monitor at night. A news telecast, except there's no one there. Just the empty news desk. Suddenly, a newscaster appears, fumbles with his cut mic, hands trembling. He tries desperately to sound confident, but his voice shakes.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you're watching this and not taking shelter underground, we urge you, do so immediately. Anywhere. Anywhere you can find. Just a month ago, this report would sound ridiculous. Aliens using Earth as a battleground, but that was before. Superman.
Something urgent is yelled from behind the camera.
Something urgent!
Our newscaster yells something back, but it's masked by flying glass. Metropolis. Something explodes through the TV network building. A blur of red and blue slams into the street like a meteor. A crater is blown into the street, already littered with pieces of concrete and steel. And with a
whoosh,
a figure lands. Human form, dressed in dark, unearthly clothing. He's a gorgeous specimen.
Powerful.
This is Ty-Zor. Confident and controlling, as he reaches down and grabs his nemesis in a blur, Ty-Zor hurls him through a building. In the rubble, something stirs. We don't really see him yet. He's obscured by a shock of red, a cape. Painfully, he gets to his feet, slowly rising, dramatically revealing a warrior in brilliant red and blue. The iconic suit is shredded. An icon on his muscular chest resembling an S. He's bloody, winded, beaten. He's exhausted as Ty-Zor is strong.
I'm disappointed. I expected a better fight.
Then Superman hears something in the far-off distance. Something no mortal could hear. A muffled female voice.
Superman! Help!
We're tight on Superman's face as he reacts to the voice. Familiar to him, and he suddenly leaps into the sky, flying off. Ty-Zor watches him go, smiles. Kelvin Observatory. An old observatory. Miles from the city. Giant domed building. Tall security fences. From nowhere, a growing
whoosh!
And Superman lands mightily. Tight on Superman's face. His eyes wide with terror at what he sees. Although we don't see what it is, we can guess. And Superman almost gasps.
No!
His skin begins to blister. He falls to his knees, shattering the marble floor as if it were sand. Kryptonian field. A flower, unlike any we've ever seen. A 5-year-old girl sits on the ground. Her hair moves in the soft breeze. An endless field awash in crimson glow. On this planet, their sun is red. Mena, Krypton, 29 years earlier. She picks another flower. She's so adorable, you could almost watch her forever. But let's continue with the show. Then her head snaps. She hears something we do not. We feel it, a deep, powerful, distant rumble. She stands, looks off worried. The rumble grows. Something gargantuan is coming. Then, something horrifying. The sky distorts, rippling like liquid, as if a stone had been tossed through it. The girl's face grows in panic as the sky suddenly begins to corrode, a yellowish acid eating away from the center of the ripple, expanding outward like a virus. We're witnessing the destruction of a protective force field that has, until today, defended this land. Dozens of the scariest warbirds you've ever seen appear, tearing through the still-expanding breach. These flying tank-like battle machines are called buzzards. And the terrified girl runs, screaming, as buried defense turrets rise, turn, and they fire. The buzzards fly back. Suddenly, this little girl is sprinting through a perilous war zone. Explosions, stone and dirt everywhere. She cries in Kryptonian. Kandor, a majestic Kryptonian city, far from Mena. This is a kingdom ruled by a great leader who lives in the building we now quickly approach, Kandor Palace. In a corridor, an officer sprints through the incredible space. He turns a corner, crying out to a group of 6 men who've moved down the hall.
Sir, the barrier's been broken. You've crossed into the border. Into Mena. They're coming!
One of the men, a rugged 39-year-old, strong of body and character, unshaken, their king. This is Jor-El. In the Kandor War Room, 3-dimensional holographs are everywhere of the attacking enemy. Translucent buzzards and troops, complex glyphs and diagrams give crucial data. Jor-El bursts in, taking the information in as a lieutenant reports to him.
They've attacked from the east and the south. Our defenses were destroyed.
Jor-El stares at the images, his heart sinking, realizing that this is the day he had been dreading for so long.
Yes. Son, tell me, do you see me yet?
The lieutenant remains fixed on his leader, hoping for a miracle. Finally, Jor-El speaks, mostly to himself.
Yes. But the solution I have is for another day.
His eyes look to a hologram of an attacking buzzard. A buzzard fires plasma blast at a distant 200-story tower. The tower explodes. Kandorians retreat, terrified. Jor-El's troops fire weapons up at the overwhelming enemy. In the launch chamber corridor, Jor-El hurries with his wife, Lara, who cries and begs.
Please, Jor-El, there has to be something else we can do. He's our son. Our baby.
Jor-El looks at her, his heart faring no better. But if he's not strong in this moment, there's no hope. He embraces her, then quietly and urgently.
My love. We have no time, you know that.
He looks into her red, wet eyes, giving her as much time as he can. Which is none. She looks at him defeated. She nods, hating this moment. Launch chamber. A portal opens. An 11-month-old infant is placed on the cushioned interior of a capsule. The baby, Kal-El, looks up hopefully at the parents who are about to send him light years away. The child, oblivious, smiles at his parents, and they look down at their son for a last, heart-rending moment. Jor-El touches the baby, and we see just how devastating this is for him, but he stays strong.
Look at this now, Kal-El. So that one day, you might remember us.
Then a distant thundering, the enemy is coming. Jor-El uses a holographic keyboard and the capsule's portal closes. We can still see the infant inside through a window as the capsule begins to fill with a clear, thick liquid. Lara chokes back tears as the oxygenated protective gel covers her son. And with an ear-shattering blast, the pod begins to rise. Jor-El and Lara watching the ascending craft, which we see silhouetted as the ceiling parts, revealing the Kryptonian sky. Jor-El and Lara hurry through the great hall to the city under siege. The palace launch tower portal opens and the pod containing Kal-El rises. Jor-El and Lara run out, looking back to see the pod into space, taking their son with it. Jor-El turns to her, enemy craft roaring through the skies above them.
Go to Tega. He'll provide your passage to the Dijo men. I can't go now, but you must. I will shield you, Lara.
Lara cries as she smiles. A nearby explosion rocks the ground, but both of the bravest face. Lara fights tears and hurries off. Jor-El watches her go. Others run past as 20 of Jor-El's soldiers fire at the two buzzards that pass overhead, cracking through the sky. Slowly, these soldiers stop firing. They react to something terrifying. A massive, city-sized troop transport in the distance. So huge that it's almost gray. We can barely make it out. It's detailed through the atmosphere, but we can see ships and troops being deployed from it. Jor-El, brandishing a large, shoulder-strapped weapon, he turns to his troops and calls out forcefully.
We will not have no one our city! Enemy soldiers approach from the south entry. Let's show them how welcome they are!
And though the situation is grim, these loyal men cheer their leader, falling out.
Bastards!
Jor-El vigorously leads his men, swearing and firing and approaching enemy troops.
It's my watch!
Then, suddenly, a large sculpture is pulverized by a mega pulse blast. Jor-El turns to look at a giant mechanical foot as it crashes to the floor in a grim, gut-pounding thud. This is a Rouser, the six-story mega mecha warrior having just landed. Jor-El stands, the last living of his men. Even though enemy troops charge for him, Jor-El doesn't give up. He fights them, one man against six. What's incredible is how physically powerful he is. A brutal warrior who is in the middle of pummeling his opponents when suddenly two dozen metallic snake-like coils appear out of nowhere and grab him. He turns his head. One figure emerges through the dust and smoldering landscape. This is Jor-El's brother, Kadazor. He walks directly to Jor-El, looks down upon him victorious, but also somehow heartsick.
I can still hear your voices in my head. You and father, returning from worship, singing the songs of Memory. He always had plans for you, didn't he? Can you imagine what he'd say now? She and me, standing like fish. What were you?
Father would know, as I do, that you won't be standing for long.
Oh, the legend's over, Jor-El. Bid your holy land farewell. The ashes of Mana will soon darken the sky.
Tied on Jor-El as he becomes terrified of what this means. Just then, Kadazor grabs Jor-El's face hard.
I know you've shot the boy off planet, but I will find him.
Sir, the pod could be headed for only one of a thousand planets.
Then send a thousand men.
Kryptonian field, no living thing can be found. Then a rumbling. A Rouser roars overhead, flies to the center of a burnt-out field. It begins firing into the ground, blasting again and again as a crater forms, hundreds of feet deep, then thousands. Soon, there's a hole over a mile deep. A portal then opens beneath it, and a giant, metallic, threatening-looking spike is lowered into the hole. The spike bomb seals itself around the crater, and then...
BOOM!
Krypton. The explosion is so massive it can be seen from space. A chunk of the planet, Meta, pulverized by the deep core detonation. Suddenly, Krypton has a bite taken out of it, like a planetary apple, or orange, your favorite fruit. Massive sections of land and molten rock erupt miles into space, and then the pods come, hundreds of them, lifting off from Krypton and dispersing into space, all headed away from the red sun, hunting down an innocent child who couldn't possibly know of the journey that lies ahead. Kent's Kitchen. Silence. As Martha and Jonathan Kent eat breakfast. Late 30s. A handsome couple.
A good couple.
Their farmhouse is modest and cozy. A timeless place. So simple, so mundane.
Good eggs.
Oh, good. I'm glad you like him. I use that new cheese. You know, with that orange label.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
What they don't see is that through the window across the farm, something the size of an SUV falls from the sky, skimming along their field, right for the house.
So, Devane called. He wants to come by for the check. As if he can't wait one day to...
Kabam! The thing strikes the earth, shatters the fence. Martha screams.
Ah!
Jonathan turns as the pod screams for them. Plowing up dirt, Jonathan dives for Martha, hitting the ground with her as dirt fills up the window. Jonathan and Martha finally sit up, mortified. They nervously approach the pod. Smoke rises, dirt everywhere.
Careful.
I am.
She stands back. When Jonathan gets to the edge of this new burnt-out ditch, what he sees bewilders him.
Oh my God.
Jonathan jumps down into the ditch, with Martha watching, and now we see it. Kal-El's pod, half buried in the earth.
Sweetheart?
I stand back.
I am.
Jonathan slowly approaches the pod. He reaches out, and just as he touches the pod, its outer shell suddenly loudly retracts. The Kents scream. Jonathan falls back. It's opened, the liquid spilling out into the dirt, revealing the 11-month-old Kal-El. Jonathan is in shock, and Martha just can't help it. She just starts to cry. She moves past her husband for the baby, her untapped maternal instinct surfacing full force.
Martha?
But she carefully lifts the wet, beautiful boy into her arms. She holds him close, lovingly. Jonathan moves behind her, both looking into the eyes of this incredible child. Pure awe. Then, Kal-El sneezes. He thinks he's terrible. Through her teary eyes...
Bless you.
In the living room later that day, a rubber ball rolls past. A moment later, little Kal-El, now wearing a diaper, takes careful steps towards the ball. Martha and Jonathan watch him. They're smitten. But it's still all very new, and so damn weird. Kal-El accidentally kicks the ball. It rolls under one end of the sofa. The Kents watch as the adorable little boy waddles over to the couch, carefully bends down to pick it up, and with one hand flips the sofa into the air. And crash! The sofa explodes through the front door frame, past their porch, and lands in the front yard. The Kents are stunned. Kal-El has his ball. He's happy.
Honey, we should probably talk about that.
Listen to me. This child is alone. He's no family. He obviously didn't come here from anywhere near here.
I'm just saying, our sofa's on the front lawn.
Yes. You know, he might have certain attributes that other children don't...
That's one way to put it.
Why or how that is, we may never know. But look at him. Jonathan, look at this beautiful boy. He's everything.
He certainly is strong.
Then we teach him restraint, to control himself. As parents, that's something we need to do anyway.
Well, that's true, honey. Normally our lives wouldn't be at risk.
This boy is an angel. Look at that face. That smile. He looks like an old-time movie star. Are you our little Clark Gable? Our strong little Clark Abe, hey? Do you like that? Clark.
Jonathan looks at his wife. There is no way he's winning this argument. He heads out.
I'm gonna go outside. Check on our living room furniture.
You stay here with Clark. And as he walks out, strong little Clark smiles at his mother. Almost 3 years later, from the distance, we hear a child laughing and...
I'm gonna get you. I'm getting closer.
And now we're close on the edge of the wheat field as 3-year-old Clark, a beaming, gorgeous boy, runs from the crops laughing. Father chases him. At the barn, Jonathan steps out, having just fixed his tractor. He wipes his hands with a rag, watching his wife and young son. and he can't help but smile. Then he runs towards Clark, playfully roaring, as if another monster were now chasing him. Clark squeals and laughs, and runs into the house. Martha and Jonathan follow. Living room. As Clark runs around the coffee table, escaping his monsters, Martha and Jonathan enter. Jonathan moves to him, feigning a scary monster.
You can't get away with that from the tickle monster.
Suddenly, Clark takes off, flying through the ceiling. For a beat, Jonathan and Martha are frozen, stunned.
Well, that's...
Martha pulls up the stairs. Clark is there, his head happily sticking through the shattered floorboards. The hens are alive.
Clark, whatever that is not okay.
They move toward him, and he rises quickly. Martha blurts a scream as Clark now hovers, loving it.
Look! You can do this?
No, Clark. No one can. People don't... I can't believe I'm saying this, Clark. People don't fly, you understand?
They don't?
No.
Sweetheart, there's no flying in this house. Bath time. Go get undressed.
But it's not even dark yet.
Bath time!
Okay.
Clark heads off to his room. Jonathan looks down at the hole in his bedroom floor. He sighs. But Martha's mind is elsewhere. She says...
It's going to be hard. Teaching him to act normal. Keeping him safe. Can you imagine? If anyone finds out what he can do, they'll take him away.
We're going to be okay. The three of us, we'll figure it out. We're a family.
Jonathan's love for Clark warms her. The Smallville Elementary School bus drives along, kicking up dust. It stops at a crossroads. The doors open. The kid's much louder now. Clark, 8 years old, gets off the bus. Clearly not one of the popular kids. He wears glasses and is even more the class outsider than he was the last time we saw him. As he gets off, he says to the driver kindly,
"Thanks, Miss McGrath.
See you tomorrow, Clark."
The doors close and the bus drives off. Clark walks home, but he can still hear the kids laughing inside the bus as it drives away, a quarter mile down the road.
Clark was sitting next to you! Did you see him in recess? What a freak!
I think he's learning the Seinfeld.
He's a freak! A total freak!
Clark, by now used to this, covers his ears as he walks.
I never get picked for sports.
Jonathan, planting a sapling, looks up at Clark, who sits on the ground near him, quietly angry.
The other kids think I can't play.
Well, that's crazy.
No, it's not. They're right. I can't throw or hit or jump or kick. Not for real. Not in front of anyone. So it always ends up looking like I can't do anything.
I know it doesn't feel like it, but your secret, the things you're able to do. It's a gift.
No, Dad, you always say that. But a gift is something you want. I'm sick of being afraid that someone might see me do something and realize I'm different. Dad, they already think I'm different.
It's for your own good.
How? They think I'm a weirdo. They make fun of me all the time, and it's not fair. You and Mom didn't have this problem. How come I do?
Jonathan weighs the fact that Clark still doesn't know he's not their biological child, but he's ill-prepared to address this right now.
Nice. Good one. Let's see another.
At farm, near the house, Clark faces Jonathan 15 feet away. He's now hitting a ball tossed to him by his father. Clark swings and hits.
Excellent. See that? You're doing great. You can hit. Let's try again. Nice and gentle, though. Come on. Good control. And just for fun, give it a little juice. Some of that camp magic. Come on, it's just you and me.
But then, almost as a warning, okay, and Jonathan pitches softly, and Clark hits the ball out of his state. Jonathan just watches it go, amazed.
Look at that.
Hub City, day. A loud, busy, multi-lane highway. A city, think Detroit. In the distance, out of nowhere, a baseball lands. Six cars and two trucks suddenly screech like mad to avoid an ugly crash. One of the cars is a boring compact car.
Why did I say that?
The driver swerves, scared in the moment. The driver happens to be a 40-ish man with thick glasses, a base couture, poorly fitting suit and a tie, and a full head of hair. His name, Lex Luthor.
What the f-?
And he angrily checks his rearview mirror as we pre-lap.
The world is doomed.
Tight on Luthor, standing, making an intense presentation, he speaks with passion that some might describe as chilling.
That is,
if humanity continues
feeble-mindedly along its current path, our disparate religions, cultures, politics, class, race, technology will result in nothing but ruination, the obliteration of all things, unless we take measures. Severe measures, radical measures. The answer is a single, central controlling government. I propose we reshape this godforsaken planet once and for all.
Lex Luthor is talking to a class of Hub City third graders. They're watching him a touch nervously. This is a classroom. Scribblings of a twisted mind on the blackboard behind him. This is when Luthor notices that at the door, an elderly nun, Sister Mary, is at the window. She angrily beckons to Luthor. He comes out to see Sister Mary, who talks quietly.
Mr. Luthor, this isn't working.
Why isn't it working?
We never realized your ideas were this extreme, or that the children were going to be as frightened as they are.
Am I getting fired? By a nun?
I'm sure you'll find your place in the world, Mr. Luthor. It's just not at St. Francis.
Luthor drives, grim. Then he notices something. Something in the sky. His horror grows, and suddenly Luthor swerves the car as a blazing yellow-red comet streaks overhead with a startling howl. He swerves again. He slams on the brakes as the comet impacts just over a small hill. Luthor breathes heavily. His glasses have come off, now broken. He recovers for a beat, then hurriedly gets out of his car. Squinting in the rain, Luthor fleets across the desolate street over the hill. He scurries up the mound of dirt, horrified at what he finds. Buried 20 feet deep in the fiery earth is another small truck-sized pod, one of hundreds that Kalzor sent in the hunt for Kal-El. Badly damaged, the thing is cracked in areas, the cockpit shattered. Chunks of phosphorus green rock surround it. Luthor cautiously climbs down to the pod. One of Kalzor's soldiers sits in the cockpit, dying. Veins can be seen through his blistering skin. Terrified, Luthor can't help himself. He moves closer.
What are...
Suddenly, the soldier grabs Luthor's neck. Luthor screams and scrambles. He tries to get the hell out of there, but the grip is too strong. Lex suddenly stops resisting, and his face begins to change. It's subtle, all in the man's expression. But as Luthor's eyes meet the Kryptonian's, his fear gradually replaced with a fierce curiosity, then a deeper knowledge.
Oh.
It's a transcendent moment, as if he's being spoken to silently. Luthor looks at the pod, its impossibly complex control panel. Quick intercut between Luthor's absorbing eyes and the control panel's instruments. Lex is so caught up in the moment that he doesn't even realize that his hair has begun to fall out, the rain washing it away in clumps. And finally, the Kryptonian dies. His grip loosens, as Luthor, now enlightened, inexplicably mutters...
Kal-El? Here?
And lightning and thunder strike as we boom up away from this sublime, bizarre moment, and we hear...
So, Clark made a discovery today.
Martha and Jonathan lie awake in bed, reading.
Yeah, what's that?
He can see through things.
Jonathan lowers his new tracker manual.
We were at the supermarket. Loretta Lang was there. Clark says, Mom, how come that lady isn't wearing underwear? Which we all know is true about Loretta.
You're kidding me. That lucky kid.
Martha hits him playfully. He smiles and kisses her. The kiss grows more passionate until very quietly...
He can hear us.
Not for extra quiet.
Beat. Then, to prove her point, she whispers even quieter.
Clark?
Then from down the hall...
Yeah?
Jonathan can't believe this.
Go to sleep.
Yay.
She smiles and she goes back to her book. Metropolis, Natural History Museum. A space exhibit. Clark, still 8 years old, walks through the exhibit with his mother, who holds a camera taking pictures.
So, Dad and I were thinking, if your eyes are bothering you, you know, you have that thing with lead, we could have some special glasses made up, you know, with some lead specks in the glass.
But Clark's eyes are elsewhere now, across the museum space. Lana Lang, 7 years old and adorable, stands at a space rock display. Martha turns and sees.
Oh, why don't you go say hi?
Nah, Lana doesn't know me.
There are only 8 kids in your class, Clark. She knows you. Go say hi. It's the nice thing to do.
A beat. Clark sighs. He gathers himself and moves to Lana. He stands there beside her, both kids just staring at the rocks. She looks at him and then looks away.
Hi, Lana. What you doing? Just looking at rocks.
Lana looks at him, not necessarily approvingly.
You stare at the wall a lot in class?
Yeah, I just like looking at clouds and stuff.
But it's just a wall. There aren't even windows.
I make my own window.
She looks at him.
You're the weirdest kid in class.
This breaks his heart. He forces a weak smile.
Lana, come on, we're leaving!
Lana walks away. Clark is left alone for a beat. Then he heads off in the opposite direction, back towards his mother. Suddenly, he gets a sharp pain and he collapses. Martha runs to him, alarmed.
Clark, what is it? Are you okay?
She gasps. Her son is in deep pain, developing veins on his skin, sores. Horrified, she quickly gathers her son and carries him out of the museum. The large glass case Clark had fallen in front of is a refrigerator-sized, sharp-spiked, phosphorus-green meteorite.
Sweetheart, you're sure you're all right?
Kent Farm. The car has just pulled up. Martha and Clark, get out.
Ma, I'm fine.
Don't you mom me, young man. If a weird green rock makes you sick, I want to know about it. There you are!
Martha jumps, seeing Mr. Devaney walk out from inside their house. He's the Kent landlord, big guy in his early 50s. Martha tries to hide her distaste for the man.
Mr. Devaney?
I let myself in. I hope that's okay.
No, it isn't. No. On the porch, Martha moves Clark past Devaney toward the front door.
If you're looking for Jonathan, he's not home.
No, I know that. Well, he told me he was going out of town for a few days.
Clark, get in the house.
Clark goes inside. Martha turns back to face Devaney. From inside the house, Clark watches through a window, his tormented eyes locked on Devaney.
I wanted to ask you, if you got that loan.
Yes. Rent will be on time this month.
Hey, you're kidding. I guess hell goes over then. No one told me.
Amused at himself, Mr. Devaney has walked closer to Martha, putting his hand on the door frame between her and the front door. Clark watches nervously through the glass.
I have an idea. You want to hear it?
I need to put my son to bed.
Oh, the boy can do that himself. You know, we could do each other a favor. You could say, this month's rent could be free. How about that?
I'd rather pay double.
I see. Lord, you look at me now.
Clark is scared.
Let go of my arm.
But Mr. Devaney kisses her. She tries to push him away. His lips go to her neck, his hands over her. She tries to move him away, but he's being aggressive. The front door opens. Clark grabs at Mr. Devaney's jacket.
Stop that.
Devaney pushes the boy back.
Get back in the house.
Clark lunges at Mr. Devaney, tackling him off the porch. Clark then grabs Mr. Devaney and throws him 20 yards across the cabin. Devaney lands hard, skimming back in the dirt towards the barn. Martha's horrified as Devaney comes to a stop. dirty and bleeding. He looks over at Clark. He looks over at Clark. Held back now by Martha. The boy is more afraid than anything else. Mr. Devaney is a mess, his eyes wide and terrified.
You're Satan!
Martha holds Clark, whose back is against her legs. Clark is fixed on Devaney, who yells words that will stay with Clark in a way define Clark for years.
Your boy's the devil! The devil himself!
Get into the house, Clark!
Devaney stumbles to his car, parked in darkness near the barn. It drives away, a cloud of dust behind it, and Martha kneels to her son, looks at him, and then embraces him.
Don't you listen to that man. You have love in your heart. You're my hero.
Kent's house, day. A view looking down the stairs of the house toward an entryway, and we hear,
Mom? Dad?
Clark enters, now 12 years old. He moves halfway up the stairs.
Mom or Dad?
But no one's home. Happy about this, Clark runs off. We find Clark at the top of a ladder, at the hayloft. He's moving aside hay, revealing Christmas presents that his parents have hidden here. He picks up a wrapped box, but unlike most kids, Clark doesn't have to unwrap anything to see what's inside. He just removes his glasses and looks through the wrapping. We see his x-ray vision, seeing through layers, paper box, and then finally, we see a note inside which reads, Clark, no peeking. Frustrated by this, he tosses that present aside and goes looking at the others, revealing a pair of sneakers. Another is a microscope, then a sweater. Then, one of the presents falls, landing on a hay-covered barn floor with a hollow thud. Clark climbs down and moves away the hay on the ground, revealing a large metallic ring, a handle for the root cellar door, something we can see in Clark's face that he has never seen before. In the cellar, darkness. Then, the ceiling opens. Clark opens the door of the cellar. Shaft of light cuts down. Clark walks down the creaky wooden stairs. Something's there, covered by a thick tarp. Clark moves to it and pulls the tarp away, revealing the pod that he landed in years ago. Clark stares at it, amazed. The silver sheen, the S engraved on its angled nose. He reaches out gingerly and touches the S, when suddenly, a compartment on the pod opens. Clark jumps back and sees the Superman suit, folded and placed securely in the compartment. The blue, red, and yellow S revealed to him for the very first time. Clark's face, his mind is racing. At the barn, the side door swings open and Clark steps out, standing akimbo, wearing the Superman suit. Of course, it's way too big for him. Behind those glasses, Clark's eyes are melodramatically fixed on the horizon. Cocky, he moves forward and trips on the cape, falling on his tuchus. He looks up, his glasses askew. He removes them, and when he stands, he has an idea. Inspired by the suit, Clark runs around his parents' property, watching the glorious red cape dance in the wind behind him. He's having a blast. As he runs around the farm, he leaps over his father's tractor, checking the cape in midair. He lands, and he keeps running, and as he runs, he approaches the barn. He strains and leaps again into the sky, but instead of coming down again, he swoops down, flying for a moment. This freaks him out and he lands hard. He's on his feet again, running faster and faster. He jumps again and he flies uncertainly, like a kid riding a two-wheeled bicycle for the very first time. As scared as he is, he laughs. He now soars into the sky 5,000 feet above Earth. He loses confidence and falls. As he falls, he screams, then forces himself to regain control. As just before he hits the ground, he flies again, swooping into the wheat fields, burrowing through the fields like an adolescent airborne mole. He flies through the stacks of hay bales again and again, not realizing that parked behind the last stack is Jonathan Kent's tractor. The impact is intense. The tractor explodes into 1,000 pieces and Clark wipes out hard. Out of breath and stunned by the impact, he stands, only to find his parents standing next to their car, having just arrived home.
He's in trouble. I
go to your room.
Clark's bedroom. Clark sits on his bed in normal clothes again. His glasses broken. Though guilty, he talks excitedly to his parents who sit before him, filled with dread. They're about to have the difficult conversation they've known was coming for years. Not that one. I was just having fun. I didn't know I could fly. I had no idea I could fly.
Clark.
I knew I could jump, but not fly. And then what I was trying to figure out was, was it the cape, the suit, or was it just me? It can't be me.
It's you.
The same way your eyes work differently than other kids. The same way you're stronger. When you were little, a few times you flew.
I flew when I was little? I did?
You know how much we love you.
Clark, that vehicle, that thing you found in the barn, that's what brought you here.
Clark is beyond confused. It takes a long beat. What?
You're not from here. From Smallville. Sweetheart, you're not from this planet.
Clark stares, horrified, numb, looking at his parents through teary eyes for an answer, but their looks make it clear. They have no idea. Clark grapples with this mega news, the realization that all he's feared is being confirmed. He's a freak, a monster. Perhaps the devil himself. Clark runs off.
Clark, honey!
Clark bolts through the Kent field, crying, trying to lose himself, wishing he weren't himself, running so hard for so long he finally collapses near the tree, which has grown considerably since it was planted. Clark sobs, the deep, painful cries of a true outsider. After a long moment, Jonathan walks up behind him.
You're going to figure this out one day, and you're going to understand why you can do the things you can, why you're here. I'm telling you, Clark, you're going to grow up. Be the first Kent to go to college, and you'll figure it all out.
But Clark can't believe this, because he doesn't believe in himself. His eyes are on the sky. He's lost, hopeless.
I know, Dad. And one day you'll be proud of me.
Son, I'm already proud.
He looks at his father. Jonathan puts his arm around his boy, and they both look up at the stars. Digimon desert on Krypton. Nighttime in a cracked earth desert terrain that seems to go on forever. And amid the rocky nothingness is a clay straw dwelling. Wispy smoke rises from a makeshift chimney. In a hut, Laura, 50 now, sits at a table, writing in a journal. Her face weathered, strong. Suddenly, a sound outside. In what seems like a millisecond, she grabs a blast staff and is on her feet, the reflexes of an animal. She steps out. She looks at the vast nighttime desert. There's no one here. So she walks through the rock structures. Then, sound! She turns. Squirrel fast! But it was just a small rock skittering down the mountainside. It's silent for a moment, and we just know we're about to get scared to death. And that we do as suddenly a giant rouser foot lands hard, crushing her dwelling. Laura screams as she shoots at the rouser, but it's useless as the whip fast silvery tentacles project the metal beast and grab Laura, dragging her to the ground as the other rouser foot lands nearby with a mighty thud. She's held now, tight, as a figure emerges from the darkness, a warrior. He removes his mask. It's Ty Zor, the terrifying warrior who we know will one day confront Superman. Only 21 years old here, he's still scary. Lara sees him, her eyes wide in fear. Three levels beneath Jor-El's former palace, Kata Zor, who's now 60, and Ty Zor head down to the fourth level. Following them is an entourage, including guards, two of them, half-dragging Lara. They're invisible. Jor-El is wire-chained to the wall, lips chapped, dried blood, scars and filth cover the former Kryptonian leader. He looks up as the cell door opens.
Yeah, you are resilient.
especially after last year's winter. You would survive down here. I'm glad you did.
Jor-El looks up, his eyes red, sick, and confused as two guards enter, dragging the wife Jor-El hasn't seen in 2 decades. He is in shock, his voice ragged.
Love!
But they quickly shove Lara to the ground, holding her head down, execution style.
Get your hands off her, you dirty fat people!
Jor-El fights his restraints, pointlessly.
My son! He found her! By chance! I almost didn't believe him when he told me. You've never met, have you? My son?
Jor-El looks up, breathing heavily and noticing that Tizor has also entered the cell. He moves forward, expression grim, staring at Jor-El, relishing the moment.
You're such a handsome boy. The same age as your own, hmm? You haven't told us in the past. This time, however, it is not you we will torture. All is well, you should know. Up there, in the real world, the Empire is under my control. As monarch, you're all but forgotten.
You deluded fool! The people hate you. They fear you.
The guard pushes her head down painfully.
Lara, stop.
Tizor steps forward, his blood boiling. Seeing his father disrespected makes him insane. He's a time bomb, a volcano about to erupt.
Much still! In the quiet of my chamber, I admit that I remain unsettled, unresolved. Tell me where to find Kal-El.
Never!
Jor-El's eyes flick to his defiant wife.
Lara, stop it, he'll kill me.
My brother, you're wise to cooperate. Tell me where to find your son.
You question why father always chose me.
Tell me where he is. You know I will show no mercy to your woman here.
Because she could see the nature of your black heart.
Tell me where he is.
They explode in equal rage.
You wanted to burn her! You said that you were going to keep my children!
Their fury is interrupted what? As Tizor suddenly grabs Hadazor's blade. He pulls it from its sheath and in one terrifying move strikes down upon Lara's head.
You bastard!
Silence. Stunned silence. Even Hadazor is chilled. As Tizor, breathing heavily, his brutal nature now revealed to the world. Jor-El is devastated. For the first time ever, Hadazor is fearful of his own son.
Clark, storeroom!
Clark suddenly sits up into frame, on his bed, breathless and unnerved. He's a college senior now. Behind him, the door opens, and his big roommate, Jerry Shuster, enters.
So Clark, I gotta get Susan. And I'll be at the party in 10. And when I get there, I want to see you inside with a potent beverage hanging from something and acting like a monkey.
I feel sick.
Yeah, it's cause you're an antisocialite and I'm forcing you to actually engage in communal activity. It's called a party, Clark.
It's like something horrible. Just
Jerry grabs a term paper from Clark's desk.
Jerry, that's my final. I have to turn it in tomorrow.
I will not graduate, leaving behind a roommate who has no social skills or direction in life. You want this back? Get your scared little ass to Dirk's and wear something dark. None of your blue and red crap.
And Jerry's gone with Clark's final box size. Frat house, nighttime. You can smell the beer and dance music thumps in our gut. Clark approaches the house nervously, drapes an obscure a view into the party. He stands out there for a moment, uncomfortable, too nervous to enter. Finally, he turns. He's gonna walk home, but then he hears...
Hey, cut it out!
And he turns back. At the front of the house are two girls. One blonde, Abby, whose back is to us, and the other, a beautiful brunette girl, are arguing. And Clark's heart stops. This is Lois Lane, incoming freshman. Clark watches as finally Lois gets convinced to re-enter the party. She disappears inside and Clark, smitten, looks around and then he removes his glasses and uses his x-ray vision through the wall of the house and he has a view of the party. The blonde girl leaves Lois alone and she stands there observing, the outsider. Then the blonde returns with a big guy. They're hiding upstairs for some fun and clearly trying to get Lois to go with them to have more fun. Clark watches and as she declines. No fun. Abby takes her arm, but Lois pulls away, making some excuse, and heads for the back of the house. So Clark puts his glasses back on, adjusts his clothes a little, takes a deep breath, and heads off. Through the kitchen windows, kids party, but out here, it's like a sanctuary. Lois is alone, looking out at the night. Then Clark walks up the steps, a beat, and it takes a little bit of courage to get to...
Ha! Great party.
It sucks.
Another beat. Clark nods. This isn't gonna work. He turns to leave when Lois says, more to herself than to him,
I cannot believe I'm here.
Me neither.
This girl, from high school, Abby Farmer, she and I are gonna be freshmen here next year. She said we needed to come tonight. We needed to network, but we're not even friends. The only reason she wanted to come was so she wouldn't show up alone. I predicted this would happen. Now Abby's almost unconscious, upstairs with some 300-pound former Lincoln High all-star football doughhead, and I'm stuck out here waiting for her to finish with him so that I can drive the 3 hours back home while she's passed out riding shotgun. Great party. Yeah, I agree. Your fly's undone.
Oh, as he does his zipper, she says, frustrated.
You know, maybe I need to lighten up. Just try and network. Hi. What class are you in? What's your major?
I'm a senior and undeclared.
An undeclared senior.
Oh, well, that was a nice non-judgmental reaction.
I'm sorry. That was rude.
I just don't know what I want to do yet, that's all. I have some other issues I'm still working on.
Well, don't listen to me. I'm a freak. I just want to skip all this and get on with it.
With what?
With life, with work, with things that actually matter. Not this.
So, what do you want to do?
I want to be the voice of the people who go through life unheard.
Whoa! I don't understand what that means.
I'm going to graduate in 3 years, move to the city, and start writing for the Daily Planet. I'm going to be a journalist. That's my plan.
Maybe it's how she smells, but Clark is in love with her. She reads his gaga stare as common skepticism.
You think I'm peculiar? Overly optimistic? Oddly ambitious? You think it's silly to want to help the underdog?
That's none of what I was thinking.
Suddenly, the door opens. It's Abby and the big guy.
Hey, so, there's another party in South Tyler's Cove.
No, I'm not going to another party.
The big guy takes Lois's arm.
Come on, I'm driving.
I said no.
Trust me, you'll have fun.
Hey.
Leave her alone.
The big guy stops, turns to Clark, pushes Clark.
Excuse me? Did I even look at you?
But instead of killing the guy, Clark is frozen. He's terrified as the big guy pushes Clark again and pushes him again. It quickly becomes clear that Clark is being pushed and won't even defend himself. The big guy pushes again. And just when it's about to get really ugly, Lois steps in.
Leave him alone.
And then the big guy turns to her, surprised. And guess what happens?
The big guy pushes Lois. Before Clark can even react, Lois slams the guy in the face, followed by a flurry of powerful, sudden blows. The big guy slams onto the porch, out cold. Clark is absolutely stunned. Abby is aghast.
Now how are we going to find the party?
We're not going to another party. We're going home.
Okay, you know what? That's why people don't like you. Because you're not, like, normal.
Abby storms off, leaving Lois embarrassed and sad. Clark watches closely as Lois heads out.
Excuse me.
Wait, what's your name?
Lois Lane. The abnormal Lois Lane. Good luck figuring everything out.
She turns and heads off. Metropolis, daytimes. We reveal our magnificent city with its powerful skyscrapers and brilliant layout. It's a masterwork. The Metropolis Bridge and the spectacular dam in the background, unlike any city we've ever seen. The Daily Planet, the large office coffee room. We meet Jimmy Olsen.
This is the break room. This is where breaks occur. Microwave, fridge, coffee, Eagle bagel slicer. Don't use it. Promise me.
As Jimmy heads out, Clark Kent follows. He's 29 now, insecure as ever. He also carries a briefcase. He moves into the sprawling newspaper office.
Foreign desk is over there. Sports, business, travel, photography, which is what I do. I'm a photographer, but I really want to get into TV. Network news, on-camera reporting, but that's really hard to break into. And we're home. I had this made for you.
He hands Clark an engraved desk nameplate, Clark Kent.
Oh, thanks, Jimmy. It's, my name's not Clark.
You're not Clark Kent?
Clark Kent.
Oh, Clark, yeah. Clark. Didn't even make sense.
There's a reporter who works here. I wonder if she...
A massive door slams. Clark turns to see the other side of the colossal space. Lois storming out of Perry White's office. She moves across the place and furiously grabs her bag from her desk, which backs up to Clark's.
What's the prop?
Lois angrily packs her bag of stuff, emphasizing angry words by throwing things into her bag.
Oh, the system's the problem. The inequity of the world's the problem. That the average citizen is unknowingly violated by the whims of unprincipled billionaires.
Mr. White's not going to print your story, is he?
And you know why? He got a call from Luther's Legion of Lawyers threatening legal action. Apparently my piece is a libelous misrepresentation of an issue Luther is addressing at the LexCorp shareholders meeting this afternoon. So I'm going over there.
Wait, what? Does Perry know?
Obviously not.
Lois, hi, I'm Clark.
Clark! Hey! But Lois is gone. At the same moment they hear... Perry White, as he arrives, a gruff, white-haired, fast-talking man, he shakes Clark's hand.
That's not a handshake. What the hell is that?
Sorry, sir, I...
Don't worry about the handshake, Count. Work on your riding. It needs it.
Excuse me?
But don't get precious. You're not one of those sensitive types, are you?
I don't,
Look, don't beat it. Look, it's your first name. Shadow Rose, son. She'll show you the ropes.
Perry slaps his arm and heads off.
First time I met Mr. White, I thought he was just a total asshole.
After a long beat, Clark looks at Jimmy, waiting for the rest of that sentence. And then Jimmy realizes...
Oh no, that's it.
Clark and Lois walk down a pedestrian-packed sidewalk through our favorite city, Metropolis. Clark keeps up fast pace with a still angry Lois as she briskly walks.
So, Lois, what's the dirt on Luther?
Dirt's a good word. I heard him speak a few months ago, accepting a humanitarian award of all things. Something about him just creeped me out. He must have that sometimes, right? Instincts about people?
On occasion, I...
All the money, the philanthropy, no, he's like Big Brother. You got a cell phone?
Yeah.
Yeah. He's spying on you right now.
Clark follows her as she crosses in the middle of a traffic gridlock street. No crosswalk.
I don't understand.
She walks, stepping past the stopped bus, turning back to Clark to say...
All you have to know is this. Luther's a deceitful, immoral, scheming, unethical jackass.
Screech!
Lois has walked into an empty lane where a large delivery truck, moving fast, slams its brakes to avoid her. Lois screams. Clark reflectively puts out his hand, and the truck comes to a sudden stop. Its rear tires almost lifting off the street for a moment. The driver jumps out.
Lady! Are you all right? Jesus!
I'm fine, I'm sorry. We should have been crossing here.
I can't believe I didn't just kill you!
As they head off, Clark says, visibly shaken, deeply worried as if he's just committed a crime and is afraid of being found out.
Excellent job, breaking. Nice.
Clark walks off, following Lois. But we stay on the driver, who then noticed the enormous dent in his truck's grill, where Clark's hand had impacted it. Let's talk building. A giant amphitheater. Well-dressed shareholders applaud the speaker at the stage podium. A handsome, cocksure, brilliant fellow is at the mic, mid-speech. Wearing a dashing designer suit and still bald head, this, of course, is Lex Luthor. The LexCorp icon looms overhead.
In this quarter, in this economy, we've surpassed earnings estimates across the board. In fact, we're doing so well that one of you kind shareholders recently sent me this!
He holds up a Luthor for President bumper sticker. The place goes insane! Lois wants to kill herself.
And I do have to say, I am getting a little bored with my square office. But an oval one...
Even more cheers of support!
Cheers of support!
Lois. Lois's incredulous eyes on Luther. She says to no one in particular, but Clark is there to hear it.
You keep thinking it can't get any worse. It just got worse. He's gonna run for president. And the scary thing? The Creek could win.
I'll save my political agenda for another time, although it does involve the construction of a wall in Mexico's backyard. But! For now, I have work to do. For you! While I may be good at bragging, I'm also able to admit Glenn LexCorp can do better. That's why next week, we're releasing a firmware update to our Luthanium chip.
Unbelievable.
Which will make all Luthanium-powered phones and computers that much more secure.
Finally, Lois can't stand it. She jumps to her feet.
Mr. Luthor, isn't it true that the new chip had security issues months ago?
Clark absolutely blanches. A murmur quickly spreads throughout the room. Next crane, including those of a creepy-looking 40-ish man in a dark suit. This is Luther's head of security, Mr. Dun-da-dun-dun. Seeing Lois, Dun-da-dun-dun reacts. This is something he did not want to happen. Luther squints against the lights. He sees Lois, smiles, apparently not threatened in the least.
Didn't an employee once make you aware of this glitch 6 months before the Luthanium chip was to be brought to market?
Clark hesitantly reaches for Lois's sleeve to tug her down, but she yanks it back, not stopping at all.
Isn't it true that your intention was to market a chip that would allow you to spy on your customers?
For those of you unfamiliar, allow me to introduce conspiracy theorist Lois Lane.
Laughs from the room as security guards head for Lois.
Who is it you're looking for, Mr. Luthor?
Lois, come on.
Clark tries her sleeve again. Again, she yanks it away.
At the moment, I'm simply looking for some courtesy.
The guards get to her now. They grab her. Clark stands, puts a hand on both of their wrists, squeezes. The guards shrink in pain. Clark takes Lois and escorts her out. Luthor watches her go, visibly annoyed. We sail over our spectacular city, Metropolis, at night.
Lois Lane is a problem.
Inside a limousine being driven through the nighttime Metropolis, Luthor sits anxiously in the back, across from Mr. Dun-da-dun-dun.
I know the type. eager to prove herself, young enough to think she's invincible. And we can't keep putting out her fires.
So you want to put out the reporter?
Just take care of it. First thing.
Now that I'm done smoking his cigarette, just nods at his boss's order to kill Lois Lane. Luther looks up. The Daily Planet. Lois sits at her computer, typing quickly. Clark at his desk, arranging it for the very first time. Where to put the pen cup? That'd be good. Yeah, there. Then he glances at Lois, looking for an in. And then...
You, asked before if I have instincts about people. I do, sometimes. I actually had one about you, years ago. We've met before, you and I, at MU. Remember? That party at Gamma House, you were an incoming freshman, I was a senior, undeclared. It was your first party? You driven there with a friend. Abby.
Are you sure it was me?
Am I sure it was? Of course! We were on the back porch. You were wearing a red sweater. It was 10:16. You beat up some guy. You...
Oh, my God. I do remember beating up some... A big guy, right?
Yes!
He had a striped shirt, a shaggy hair...
Yes!
And you were there?
This is unbelievable.
I'm sorry. I think you had a really good memory.
It doesn't matter. I only brought it up because you sort of inadvertently helped give me some direction that night.
I did?
Yeah, and I just wanted to say
thank you! I just spent 45 impossibly unpleasant minutes on the phone with Luthor's attorneys defending you against a slander suit. If you ever, and I mean ever, behave that way again, I will fire you from every job you'll never get.
Yes, sir.
Harry holds up a memo for her.
You have no problem working on the weekend, my dear.
What is this?
You and Jimmy are in the pool.
Air Force One?
First thing in the AM. And you weren't my first choice, so don't get cocky.
Perry looks at Clark's misspelled nameplate.
Learn how to spell your name.
Yes, sir.
Perry leaves. Lois reads the memo. She beams with excitement. Clark smiles for her.
Oh, my God. Jimmy's got a freak. Would you mind proofing this for me?
Of course not. Congratulations.
Thank you. I'll see you tomorrow.
Lois heads off, and then, mid-office, she's struck by an epiphany. She turns back, thrilled, pointing and exclaiming,
"Your fly was undone!"
Yes! Thank you, it was!
He practically laughs, watching Lois happily head off. Air Force Base the next morning. Bright and early, Lois Lane and Jimmy Olsen move through a security checkpoint. They continue onto a tarmac towards Air Force One. White House staff and members of the press climb the stairs to enter the plane. Lois and Jimmy follow. LexCorp office corridors. The whip stops on the LexCorp corridor as a frustrated Luther bustles around a corner through the busy corridors of this outer office. A sexy female secretary, Miss Conroy, walking quickly with him, holding his briefcase and talking even faster than their gait.
You owe calls for the Journal and the Register.
Don't say I owe calls. Just tell me who called.
The Times, the Daily News.
Which Times?
Both. And a gentleman called from the Justice Department.
What?
Apparently the President has asked that LexCorp be investigated.
Okay. A little advice. When the Justice Department calls, that's the first thing you tell me about!
Luther enters his office, closing the door on Miss Conroy. An extravagant office, a view of the glorious metropolis. A wall of TV and data monitors. Dun-da-dun-dun is here.
Did you take care of it?
Not yet. Lane's been assigned to Air Force One this morning. It's gonna have to wait till Monday.
We push in on Luther, who looks off, mind spinning. A beat.
Not necessarily.
Metropolis. A long shot, our favorite city in the distance, flying towards us,
away from the city is the LexCorp helicopter. It roars past as Luther flies fast, dun-dun-dun-dun, beside him. At the Kelvin Observatory, a long shot. The place we saw during the film's opening, remember? Miles from Metropolis. The chopper lands. Clang, clang, clang of the trolley. Ding, ding, ding with the bell. Lights come on, and Luther and then dun-dun-dun-dun move across the large domed space. But now we see it. A place that's been converted into a wild technological research lab, where a telescope once sat, a 30-foot-tall aerial now resides, attached with cables to a Krypton pod that Luther found years ago. While still in disrepair from its crash landing, the thing has been worked on for years. Chunks of the green rock on examination tables. There's also a giant glass water tank used for any number of experiments. Luther moves to one of his computers and starts typing. An Air Force One staff member walks down the corridor. She approaches Lois.
She?
It's in the script, still on his voice.
Miss Lane, the president's ready to see you.
Thank you.
As Lois goes, the confused passenger with a strange voice leaves as well. Putting back the air sneakers bag.
Don't bark on the press, Lois.
Insert a computer monitor. Machine code scrolls across the screen. Triangulation. GPS coordinates. Core code spills across the screen in rapid succession. Kind of like a matrix. Among the banks of numbers, the unique chip ID numbers, remote access accounts, and firmware codes for the brains of the Air Force One appear. At the observatory, Lex considers what he's about to do, as if whatever conscience he has is vying to be heard.
You're taking down Air Force One? Yes, to off the reporter.
Two birds with one stone, Mr. Dun-da-dun-dun. This is an act of efficiency.
Luther then types three numbers and hits enter, activating the Luthanian chip at the heart of the plane's controls. He grabs a remote, aims it at the bank of dozens of television monitors. They all come to life with world broadcasts.
Let's watch the news.
Air Force One cockpit. The pilot flies the plane. Thank God. Who else is going to fight it? Suddenly, their instruments go dead. Not a laughing matter. Panic. An alarm sound. The plane plummets, banging.
Oh my God.
Lois falls to the floor. People scream as everything tilts. One of the journalists on his cell phone reports.
Oh my God, Robert, we're going down. We're going to die.
The president and his wife and daughter, surrounded by Secret Service agents, terrified. Holding on. The plane dives hard, and suddenly, an engine blows. Black smoke pouring from them as the plane plummets. Shower. Clark is taking a shower.
No, this is a good moment for the female audience.
He sings a song, oblivious to the horror that's in the sky. At the Kelvin Observatory, no more wolf whistling, ladies. Luther, unless you like Luther. Luther watches his monitors as networks start interrupting their broadcast with breaking news bulletins about Air Force One. Air Force One. It's mayhem on the airplane. Technical chatter, alarms blaring. Lois holds on, horrified.
Clark's bathroom.
Clark, done with his shower, turns off the water, steps out, wraps a towel around his moist waist, and just then he hears distantly.
You received information from a source on the airplane that Air Force One has lost power.
And suddenly Clark turns, not dropping his towel, uses his X-ray vision to look through his wall at the apartment adjacent to his, where a woman, ironing, is watching the television, the news broadcast.
That the airplane is, at this moment, plunging toward Earth.
Clark stumbles out here and rips open one of the many cardboard moving boxes, revealing his Superman suit. He holds it, but instead of quickly putting it on, he begins to sweat. He's terrified. He's definitely going to need another shower. In fact, he begins to have an anxiety attack, breathing heavily. He drops the suit on the box again. He paces. He sits in his chair, squirming uncomfortably. In this, the most difficult moment in his life, Lois is too. The airplane dives. Terrified, Lois screams. Clark, in the chair, squirming, desperate to convince himself.
Get it together. You can do this. I know. Thanks.
And finally, he grabs the suit. Crack! As the roof access door bursts open and the hinges, and Superman appears. The vast, pristine city is his backdrop. And he runs towards the edge of the building. We expect him just to take off, but suddenly he changes his mind. He plants his feet and skids 20 feet, finally stopping inches from the edge. Sweat on Superman's brow. Holy sheep! No, no. This is very difficult for Clark. Breathing heavily, he closes his eyes, beginning to hear the news reports from all across the city. Starting off as one, then three, then eight, then loads! A cacophony of hundreds of broadcasts!
Hard to know where in the sky this plane will crash. What remains to be seen? There's little hope for Air Force One. God bless the people on that airplane.
And suddenly, Superman leaps, blasts off into the sky. It's big. The moment is rousing and spectacular and amazing! Air Force One spin dives. Two F-18s appear, flanking the falling aircraft. One of the pilots into his radio says,
"Negative, that. There's nothing we can do from here."
Lois is trying to climb up toward the rear of the plane, tears streaming down her face. Piercing the clouds, a human bullet blurring through the sky, Superman blasts across the horizon. Then he stops, steadying himself, still new to flight. He senses alert. He scrutinizes the sky. He takes off again. Metropolis, pedestrian, looking upwards.
Look up in the sky.
It's a bird.
No, no, that's a plane.
Oh my god, that is a plane.
Huh. Air Force One. Spin dives. F-18 still flanking. Superman approaches the plane. He's unsure and afraid of himself as he reaches for a wing. The plane spirals, but he grabs onto a wing, strains to stop it. The pilot, having seen Superman, is astonished.
Fellas.
Superman struggles. He pulls on the wing, desperately straining to stop its spiral. But suddenly, the edge of the wing breaks off. Superman goes tumbling as the plane dives further, controlling himself in flight. This is no easy task. Superman manages to get his bearings, quickly bulleting back towards the plane. Superman grabs another wing closer to the fuselage. We counter-rotate in the sky as he tugs with all his might, finally stopping the plane from spinning. On board, Lois gets to a window, looks out, sees Superman for the first time. Ginny arrives beside her. Terrified, sees Superman. They're both agog as Superman flies back underneath the belly of the plane. Hoisting the entire aircraft on his back, Superman labors like a brand new soldier in battle for the first time, with no choice but to learn on the job, and he's doing a great job. He begins to lift the plane. He screams like an Olympian Russian weightlifter as he restores the plane's normal altitude. Lois in disbelief, Jimmy too, the president and his family confounded, look out the window, trying to see. The crew reacts.
Why? Good job.
I'm not doing anything.
On the F-18, the pilot's eyes are locked on Superman.
Is anyone else seeing this?
I don't think so.
Kent's farm. 67-year-old Jonathan Kent has stopped working for a moment on his tractor, listening to his transistor radio.
Air Force One, ladies and gentlemen, this is what is being reported. Air Force One is being carried to safety by a man in blue.
you've ever done.
I'm sorry, this has to be some kind of sick joke. I'm a D-dog.
In his blue house with a blue window, Jonathan looks up amazed. How? Not feeling blue, but exhilarated. Metropolis Park, in the middle of a baseball game, the swing, better, better, hey, better, better, swing makes contact as the ball goes up high. We see Air Force One being carried into the stadium by a flying man in a full body blue double-deed-of-blue suit and a cape that's red. The capacity crowd goes absolutely silent. In shock.
Should we put down the landing gear?
Sure, what the hell?
At the Kelvin Observatory, Luther moves close to his monitors, expecting an Air Force One story, but not this Air Force One story.
What is that?
You'll find out in a minute.
Kent Varn! Holding his transistor radio, Jonathan Kent hurries through the field. He runs towards the house.
Martha, you won't believe this.
And then, oddly, Jonathan slows. He stops. What's happening? It almost seems like he's something horrible has just occurred to him. Or is it something more? Metropolis Park. The crowd is still very silent. The baseball players backing up in wild disbelief as Superman gently sets down the presidential jumbo jet. Out of breath, nervous, and exhausted, Superman looks up at the crowd. A moment of absolute silence again. And then, like a sudden volcanic eruption, deafening cheers! The stadium becomes the source of the loudest crowd response in history. Massive yelling, laughing, shock, applause, picture-taking. Superman, Clark, suddenly beams. Like a moment that he's been waiting for all of his life. The most incredible public revealing of himself. And to get this kind of support and acceptance is rather overwhelming. At the observatory, Luther at the TV monitor, touching the screen in amazement. A religious moment for him.
I knew I'd find you.
Back at the park, people start rushing the field as emergency chutes inflate and Secret Service agents begin sliding off the plane, followed by the president, who moves towards Superman. Agents try to hold him back, but the president insists, approaching cautiously.
Excuse me. You speak English?
Yes, sir.
Well, son, I'd like to say two words. Two words! I've never met more sincerely.
Excuse me.
Superman hurries past the president, directly up to Lois Lane, who has just slid down the emergency chute. The president just stands there, slighted. Lois looks up. Superman's hand is there. She takes it, and he helps her to her feet. She looks up at him, her breath taken away.
Are you okay?
Astonished, she looks him up and down.
Who are you?
And for a moment, Superman is simply perplexed that she doesn't recognize him.
Who? I'll give you a hint. Fly.
Yeah, I saw you. How did you get back? Where are you from? What's your name?
And as she talks, she's drowned out by the barrage of questions from the mass of people who rush Superman.
Hey,
what's your waist size?
Down the ship now, taking pictures along with hundreds of others. The approaching crowd just a little too much for Superman. As he becomes separated from Lois, he looks back to her, whose eyes are locked on him, beholden, captivated. Finally, he calls out,
"Hey, I'll see you soon."
Yeah. And with a magnificent leap, Superman bounds into the sky. Everyone gasps.
Yes.
Some people faint. Don't faint. I know it's warm, but don't faint. Cameras catch every moment, including Jimmy's.
Did he tell you his name?
Lois's eye... Why... Yeah. Rewind. Lois's wide eyes watch the red streak in the magnificent sky.
He's Superman.
A Superman, perhaps. And it catches like wildfire throughout the crowd. Everyone saying the name for the very first time.
Superman!
The baseball team manager emerges and he yells furiously.
Who's up first?
Where the hell is he going? He's leaving the plane right there? Are you kidding me?
And that's a wrap on part one of the show. So what do you think so far? JJ took a few bold steps in rewriting the legendary Superman mythology and not having Krypton explode like they usually do. But instead, it's in the midst of a crippling civil war. Like, I'd say if it was made, there'd be serious fan backlash to, like, that change. It's a huge, significant change. But when I was reading it, I actually really like it. It's new, it's fresh, it's compelling. And it didn't bother me at all when reading it. When I first heard about it, I was like, are you kidding me? He can't get away with that. But he really pulls it off. I also really like the early scenes of Clark Kent growing up, from the flying baby to the disgruntled, or the kind of confused kid. There's a tenderness and warmth there. I think they really create standout moments. Especially when you compare it to the coldness of Man of Steel's childhood scenes. That was really kind of dark and brooding, where I always like the sunshine elements of Smallville. And if you actually read the first draft, Superman's suit was actually a character itself. It would fly around and it would have a little personality, but they actually removed that from draft 2. And I really think that the Air Force One sequence would have been really fantastic, except Bryan Singer actually used it in Superman Returns, so it felt really familiar. But that's not a diss on the project. It was actually just taken from this script and put into Superman Returns. I don't really have too many negative things to say about this so far. I mean, I think it's really strong as a script. Now, they handle Superman and Clark Kent really well, although I wasn't really engaged with the meeting Lois Lane in college and impacting Clark's life element. That felt a little forced, and I just think it was a bit too contrived. But hey, all in all, it's solid, so great work, JJ. And that will wrap up our first half review. So tune in next week for part 2 of Superman Flyby Live. Don't forget to subscribe and share this episode with your peeps, peers, and friends. My name is Chris Brennan. On behalf of Stevie Ryan, see you next time.